Hello, welcome to the Easy Button. I'm your host, James Prendergast, and my co-host here tonight is...
Taylor Boone, how you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Yourself?
I'm doing great. It's great to talk with you again.
Yeah, it's been quite a while now since our last podcast, although for all people listening, it's been a very, very short time. Amazingly, it's the wonders of the internet. So I think we'll just get straight into what we've been doing. I thought we'd talk about what we've been playing first. Do you want to go first, or shall I?
Sure, I'll go in first. So I've been playing a lot of old games. I've been playing Left 4 Dead 2, a lot of it. I love that game. That game is, it's great. It's very difficult.
Isn't this a new game? Like, relatively new.
Well, it came out last fall. So we're getting on to 6 months in. But co-op is just fantastic. And their versus mode is fantastic. Even though I'm probably the world's worst versus player, it's...
Do you prefer, like, zombies or the humans?
I like the zombies because it's like griefing for goodness. Like, the game has set you up to grief, and that's a good thing. And your whole reason for being there is to make life as difficult as possible for the survivors. And that's a lot of fun. And even if you are not very good, you can still get your licks in and make, you know, help your team out. Even if you're just hurt, yeah. You know, even if you just hurt one of the survivors a little bit, that helps over time. Yeah. The survivor part of the versus is not as, it's fun. It's very challenging because you never really know what's around the corner. You never know what's going to happen. It's so dynamic.
Yeah.
The other team really makes, you have to be very careful and calculated in what you're doing. So that makes it a lot of fun, but it makes it very, very hard.
I do have a question. You know, sure. In the first Left 4 Dead, like, they basically made the verses so you could actually run through them very quickly, and the zombie team couldn't respond fast enough if you were, you know, speedrunning basically through a level. Is that kind of mitigated in Left 4 Dead 2, or...?
Well, you can still speedrun, and that's a very valid tactic to use, but... they make it a lot more difficult because the maps are most of the maps are quite a bit longer. Mm-hmm. So if you run, the other thing is if you run, you tend to get spread out, and if you're by yourself in this game, then you're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Even if you're far ahead of everybody, they also made it a little bit easier. I'm trying to remember from Left 4 Dead 1, they made it a little bit easier for the infected to keep up with the survivors. So you don't tend to have, once you spawn in, of course, you need to attack, but you need to attack anyway. And as long as you're not spawned in, you can keep up with the survivors easily. So you can always get in front of them and attack them. I believe Left 4 Dead was like that as well. But once you spawned in, if you didn't attack in Left 4 Dead, you're kind of hosed. Whereas now, some of the infected, you still have that problem that they move very slow. But most of the time, you can catch up and get around. And there's enough paths to get around. The beauty of the game design is, a lot of the levels are very open, so there's a lot of different paths for you as an infected to go circle around and converge on the survivors and make it, you know, make their life really bad.
that was a problem in Left 4 Dead, wasn't it? Like the levels were too linear and too close, so the infected couldn't really move around the survivors without being killed.
Yes, that's right. And yes, it was very linear. Very high walls, or in a lot of indoor areas, whereas in Left 4 Dead 2, a lot more is outdoors. And there's a lot, even in Left 4 Dead, the original game, the outdoors were more linear as well. There's only really one path, even though you're outside. There was, you know, the fake walls or whatever, what have you. the out of bounds area was kept you on the straight and narrow, whereas Left 4 Dead 2, a lot of these outdoors areas are very, very big, and there's a lot of different ways through them. So you can go around, and as the survivors, you can go around as well. You can go in a path that people don't expect, and that's a good valid tactic as well. Although I think since the game has been out as long as it has, most people know what the have kind of come to what an optimum path is for any given map.
Yeah, that's fair enough. So, you know, because before the release of Left 4 Dead 2, because I don't actually have it, they were talking up the kind of dynamicness of the maps. Like, some maps would have variable paths depending on what you did in the actual level.
Right.
Is that a big feature, or is that not really used that much in multiplayer?
Well, I think they took most of that out. Even in the co-op, there's very little difference in your path for a given, you know, run through of a given map. So, yeah. So I think that kind of fell on the cutting room floor. We're talking about it being all dynamic, but now it's, you know, it really is. There's, even though there's a couple of different paths, you're really going for the same goal, and there's no, or at least not in my experience, there's no cut off. You know, you're cut off here, and so you have to go around because the director decided that you shouldn't go there. There's none of that really going on. So there's a lot of that, I think, didn't make it into the final shipping version of the game. Because that would be very difficult to do from a design perspective, right?
I mean, yeah and no. I mean, like, you could, I don't know, maybe you could, you know, like in the original one where you blow up the petrol station.
Right.
Like, you didn't have to blow it up, did you?
Right.
So, but maybe that could have triggered like a collapse of a walkway that you would have used to, that kind of design that would have been, it's not too complicated to implement, but I don't know if that's in Left 4 Dead 2 or not. I don't know.
No, it's that sort of thing's not. And the way I understood it, the director would decide whether there was a walkway there or not, or there was an alternate way to go to your, get to your, you know, your destination. So,
yeah.
And that, yeah, I haven't seen any of that. And I played, like I said, I've played a lot of that game recently. That's probably my most played game.
Would you say you're addicted?
Getting close. having just come off of the next game I played a lot, which is Team Fortress 2, I am over my addiction to that game. I still enjoy it. It's a lot of fun, but there for almost 2 years I was playing it 4 or 5 times a week, and
is it because no one's playing it anymore, or is it because
no? There's still a good community of people playing. There's still a lot of full servers. I think it's just you know, you play something for that long. It's even though they keep coming out with content, what seems to be happening over time, and this is kind of an interesting phenomenon, is release a game, they release content sporadically, and that would regenerate everybody's desire to play the game. But over time, there's a lessening effect. So the last update, everybody was really, you know, the group that I play with, everybody was very excited about it and got into it, but it only lasted for like a week. So, and then the,
like
then the population
would have been like a month or something else.
Right. That's exactly right. So you're starting to see a little bit of diminishing returns, and I'm wondering how long Valve will continue to release free content for that game, because I play on the PC, so I don't pay for anything except for the game. I wonder how long Valve will continue to keep releasing that free content for that game that's, you know, is over 2 years old, which is kind of amazing that it still gets the amount of play that it does. On the Gamers for Jobs forums, we have a dedicated crew who play twice a week, and then those are kind of stated matches, and then every night somebody will get on and try to play.
Yeah.
But the further we go out, the less people will come on, like on a random Wednesday night, for instance. Which is, you know,
it's fair enough. I mean, it's the general curve of people playing games, isn't it?
Right.
But well, I did find it very interesting how slowly they've, I mean, okay, Valve are, you know, traditionally perfectionists anyway, but how slowly they've dragged out these updates. So you haven't got, is it the Spy you haven't got the updates for, and the Pyro?
No, the Pyro and the Spy both have updates.
Oh, they're both out now.
You don't have, the Enchi doesn't have any. They got a minor update.
The Engineer.
The Engineer. But every other class has had a full update. They have full alternate weapons. for every, you know, you have three slots in the game.
Okay. Yeah.
So they have full alternate weapons. The last update they did was the soldier in the demo man update. And so they got all alternate weapons there. And so that kind of, I think they're still working on the engineers update, because that's a hard one.
You know, to balance.
Yeah, very, very much so, I would imagine. So,
yeah.
But, you know, they'll probably release that here in a little bit, and hopefully some new maps, and everybody gets psyched to play again, because it is it's such a fun game. I mean, it's so, it's so incredible. I mean, even after playing, like I say, seriously, 4 or 5 nights a week for 2 years, that game is still fresh, just because the team makeup and the total dynamic nature of the combat means that every time you play through a map, it's different. Even though it's the same old map that you've been beaten on for however long, you know, I've probably played Dust Bowl, which is one of the maps.
Yeah.
1,000 times?
I mean, the thing is, I think anyone who's played multiplayer in the last 10 years can understand that. I mean, I played Quake 3 religiously for about 2-3 years. I must play the same maps over and over again over 1,000 times in those, because there aren't that many. And I was playing for about 8-10 hours a night, like every night, because I was playing in leagues and stuff.
Right.
And you think, you'd think you'd get bored, wouldn't you? But you don't. It's just, it's the people who provide the variation rather than the actual setting you're in.
Right, that's very true. And we do have a very good group of people over at Gamers with Jobs. I mean, go look at the T-Fortress thread. It dwarfs any other thread on that forum. I mean, they're up to, I think we're up to 23,000 posts or something like that.
Really?
It's crazy. Whoop, I promised I wouldn't use that word.
Did you?
I think I did.
You didn't promise me.
Okay. So, but those are old games. Here's a game that's new to me, although it's old as well. And I know this is going to break your heart, but Dead Space.
I love Dead Space.
I know you do. I've heard you mention it before.
Oh, no, you don't like it.
I want to. I really, want to.
I don't mind.
Okay.
But if you said you didn't like the new Prince of Persia, I would have killed you.
Okay. I haven't played the new Prince of Persia, but...
Thank God. Don't play it, please.
So I'm playing Dead Space on the PC, and I don't know if it's a poor port, or if it's something intrinsic to the game, but I understand. So my big complaint is I feel claustrophobic as the player, and I understand that that's what they're trying to go for, but it's so claustrophobic that I don't enjoy it as a game. So I wish they could have moved the camera back maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because, and perhaps this is my PC bias showing, but it's just, as a shooter or as an ostensible third person over the shoulder shooter, it just doesn't really work, because I have no sense of context or peripheral vision when I'm playing the game. And I just feel like, I don't, and like I say, I know that that's an effect that they're going for. And I just wish that they could have pulled that back a little bit to give a little bit more of the peripheral vision.
Yeah.
Because PC game, any of these sort of games have a problem with that anyway. And this is just exacerbated in my mind to the point where it really is almost unplayable. And I'm trying to get through it because a lot of folks have said some, you know, very, very good things about the game, but I'm just not having any fun. So
that's fair enough. I mean, I actually completely agree with you. Even though I love the game, I didn't really have that problem with it. I think when you love a game, you can oversee, you can kind of gloss over the faults a little bit, can't you?
Right. Yes.
I mean, any person who does that, you know, any walk of life, you gloss over the faults. But yeah, I mean, I've always had the problem with first-person shooters on consoles and more recently with on PC as well, where they have this, especially Valve games, they have this obsession with having viewing angles of 70 degrees,
right,
which is completely unrealistic. Right. And it feels like I'm in, you know, horses, when they have the blinkers on.
Right.
So they don't get scared of the road.
Yes.
That's what I feel like. I feel like I'm sitting there and something is over my head, and like a hood or something, and I cannot see. And the, you know, the gun takes up 3/4 of the screen, which is completely unrealistic unless you're holding it up to your face, which you're not doing generally. But yeah, I mean, I understand where you're coming from there. That's the reason why I could never play the original Resident Evil on consoles.
Right.
Because you're so restricted in how you're presented the game. But for some reason, I think I love Aliens, like the film.
Right, yes.
And I love that kind of survival horror. Yes. I do like that survival horror thing, but not usually in games. I liked, I don't know if you ever played it, but on the PS2 and the Xbox, it was Project Zero 2, Crimson Butterfly. And that was a brilliant game with the kind of the camera obscura and stuff. And that's kind of the same kind of atmosphere that Dead Space reminded me of. But yeah, I completely see where you're coming from. There's a kind of restriction there that it makes you feel, it's a disconnect between what you feel in reality and what you feel in the game.
Right.
And yes. you can't overcome that unless you really, really, really like the setting.
Right. And the setting, like I say, I really want to like this game because the setting is from what I've played, I probably got it an hour and a half or 2 hours in. And the setting is fantastic. And, you know, the production values are incredible.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful game on the PC. I'm able to max everything out. The sound design is creepy.
Spot on, isn't it?
Which is exactly what they're going, right? It's perfect. Yeah. And I, like I say, I understand that they're trying to go for this claustrophobic feeling where you just never know what's over your shoulder. But to me, it just pisses me off more than it makes me scared, right? It just, when I can't see enough of the screen or can't see enough of what's ahead of me and on the sides of me, it just pisses me off. And that's killing me on this game. That's what's killing this game for me, which, like I say, it's too bad because I really, really want to play it and enjoy it.
Have you looked online for any hacks? I mean, there might be some, you know, kind of FOV, you know, field of view hacks.
Yeah, maybe something. So. I have thought about doing that. I have not gone off my lazy tail to go.
To be fair, I didn't look myself. But yeah, I remember when I played, I can't remember whether I maxed out or you know, minned out, whatever you call it, like my mouse speed, because sometimes you want to be able to just turn on a a needle head, whatever you call it.
Yeah, so the mouse is a little bit soft on this game, and that's, I think, that's a console port issue. It's a little soft by default, and yes, they do give you the ability to adjust it. I have adjusted that. That helped a little bit, but mainly with the UI, right? Because the UI, trying to select menus was really
floaty.
Oh,
it's all console-based, isn't it?
Very, very floaty, yes.
Yeah.
They're expecting you to press the down.
The enter button.
Right, yes. And they're not expecting you to be rolling a mouse around on a mouse pad somewhere trying to get to the next menu item. So that's Dead Space. Like I say, I really want to like it. I'll probably continue to try to slog through a little bit more, see if it catches up. Yeah. But
to be fair, you probably mean spoiling a little bit here if you haven't played it. There's a portion between about 2/3 and 4/5 of the way through.
Okay.
Or whatever, whichever way around that is. you have to shoot. It's like a kind of. Do you remember, like, is it. Not asteroids, but Earth Defense. The city defense, and the asteroids are coming, or the beams are coming down from the sky. You have to defend your cities. ICBM defense or something like that.
Right, or there's
on
like.
The arcades.
Right.
A little rollerball.
Yep.
It's like that, but with a mouse. And the mouse is set to a sensitivity of 1 out of 10.
Great.
And that's the kind of thing, that was really frustrating for me, I think for a lot of people as well. And it's the kind of thing where you look at the whole game, and you think how well it was designed, and the sound, and as you say, the atmosphere, and the graphics are all pretty much perfect, but the controls really let it down.
Right. Well, that's too bad, but I probably won't make it that far, but hey, if I do, that'll be
Be forewarned.
Well, that'll be something, right? That'll mean the game has hooked into me in a way that I don't see it doing right now. So,
yeah,
you know, and so I've got a couple other games. Two of them I just want to mention in passing that I've been spending an inordinate amount of time with, and I don't really understand why. Well, actually, I do understand why. I take that back. Arcanum.
Oh, yeah.
Of Steamwork and Magic Obscura, right?
Did you get that from GOG?
Got that from GOG.
Oh, yeah. I've been thinking about that.
I've always loved that game, and I got the widescreen mod. There's a user mod that patches up and fixes a bunch of stuff, even over and above the last patch. And I played a long time ago. I probably played it through two or three times. And I love that game. That game is so awesome. And I'm really enjoying it. The widescreen mod really makes it enjoyable on a modern PC. I'm running it at 1280 by 1024.
Yeah.
And it works great. And, you know, they have a font hack in there so that the font is big enough to read at that resolution. And what a just a great, awesome game. And I wish they would make more games like that. Maybe not as buggy as it was when it first came out, but the subject matter is just so incredible. They just, Troika. Oh.
They were a good studio, although flawed.
Yes, yes.
So are there community patches out for that game then?
Yes, there are community patches out for it. So somebody's gone in, and I believe they've ported what the Wayday editor for that was used in for fan made patches for Baldur's Gate and Baldur's Gate 2 over to Arcanum, and using that to patch up and dig around and find the dialogue options and characters that were turned off. And so they brought a lot of that stuff out and fixed a lot of quests and over and above what the last official patch did. And, of course, I'm not very far into it yet, but I'm just kind of savoring it. I'm just not really trying to drive through it very fast. I'm just kind of taking my time and enjoying the game and reminiscing about how awesome it was back in the day when I first played it. And just all those wonderful, wonderful reminiscent sorts of things. And just kind of basking in how incredibly great this game is. And it's really, I think, I think the people who know or, you know, quote unquote, in the know, appreciate this game and know about it and appreciate it for what it is. Of course, most people don't know and would look at it and totally hate it because it's pretty obscure from a mass market sort of perspective. I mean,
nowadays, I mean, like Baldur's Gate probably compared to Arcanum is probably quite mainstream, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, comparatively. So it never really had the uptake that it deserved because it was a buggy mess when it was released. There's no way to defend that, right? There's no way to say that it didn't happen. But it's just a fantastic game. And another fantastic game that I'm getting into, I picked up at the Steam Christmas sale, is Knights of the Old Republic.
Oh, yeah.
I'm playing through that, and you know what it really reminds me of? I'm sure there's some truth to this, although I have no way of proving this. It really reminds me of it's a precursor to Mass Effect. If you look at it,
it's the same developer.
Same developer, but the same sort of, you know, obviously the mechanics and the math that are going on behind the RPG portion of it are different because they're using the D&D 3rd edition rules, whereas Mass Effect is using whatever stuff BioWare came up with. But just the tone and the characters and the interactions, and they're just all it really reminds me a lot of Mass Effect, and I had never really put two and two together and put those two things together and seen how similar they are until I went back and played started playing through Knights of the Old Republic again. It's just, you know, it's on my pile of shame. I never finished. I got about halfway through and then got distracted and never gone back to it. And so that's why I decided to play it, is I want to get through and finish it off.
Yeah.
And just again, what an incredible game.
To be fair, I think KOTOR, as they call it, as all the cool kids call it, I don't think the story is any good after the big plot twist. If you know what I mean.
There's a plot twist?
There is a plot. Well, there is, yeah. I don't know how far you've got into it. How far are you into it?
I just had a couple hours in right now. And I only got about... Okay. I only got about halfway through.
Last time.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit... Maybe a little bit past that, but I didn't get... I didn't see a plot twist, so...
Okay, I won't ruin it then.
Spoiler!
I know, I won't go there, but... I have to say, I didn't see it coming, and I thought it was really, really good. But after that point, the gameplay was just... It didn't make any sense. Like, you were this uber-powerful Jedi, and you were fighting these minions, and yet you weren't killing them in one hit with your sword, which could cut through anything, pretty much.
Right.
And that's the one thing, that's a problem I have with RPGs and the Star Wars setting, is that lightsabers aren't realistic.
Well,
I remember on the Games with Jobs, there was this, there was an article about how lightsabers are, you know, one-hit kills, basically.
Should be.
Oh, well, depends on, they invented, was it cordite or something? Some kind of material which is resistant to lightsabers. So stuff like that, I understand, you have dark troopers which are resistant to lightsabers and things like that. But it's just, at some point, you're no longer a special agent in the world. You're just another minion, because you're... attacks and stuff are leveled, the dependence on the levels of other people in the game. I think that detracts a little bit from the setting.
Well, and then that's not to get too far afield, but isn't that a traditional RPG trope? To keep it quote unquote challenging throughout the end of the game, you want to have people who will test your mettle all the way through. Yeah, I don't like that very much either, because if you are truly this badass Jedi, people should be running away from you if they see you coming, right? I mean,
yeah.
Unless, you know, there are people who are of equal power to you. And so, yeah, if you're a minion, you should probably not be wanting to engage a powerful Jedi. But but from a gameplay perspective, you got to keep... You know, to keep the player engaged, if you will, that you have to provide them some sort of test, I guess.
Well, I always saw it like a kind of Matrix 2 dealy. I mean, you know, as Matrix 2, when all the or maybe Matrix 3, but you know, where all the agent, what's his name, Agent Smith,
right?
Is it? Yeah, all Neo's in the playground or square or something, and all the Agent Smiths run in and he fights them all. That's the kind of thing you want as a Jedi, fighting minions, you know what I mean? So all these dark Jedi, all these Sith, they're all, like, pitiful snotlings, you know what I mean? You don't care about them. But they see you, they run away, and then you come to this arena, and they all pile in on you, thinking, you know, the law of numbers, they should be able to get in one good shot, and since your lightsaber's basically a one-hit death, then your law of averages is on their side.
Right.
But, I mean, that hasn't happened in a game so far. There's been no cool instance where you're this awesome dude, basically, fighting off waves of... I don't mean in cannon fodder. I mean you having to execute your moves in a strategic way. Because in RPGs, it tends to be turn-based, or it tends to be like instance-based. So you don't have the waves and waves of enemies like you do in, say, Horde mode, or whatever you call it these days.
Right.
Survival mode in AVP.
I do see what you're saying, although I do think there's one example where you are an uber, or you can become an uber badass if you play long enough, and you can do one-hit kills on pretty much anybody in the game, and that's Oblivion. I played that game long enough that I could one-hit kill... Yeah. Anything. Now, you don't get the horde. You don't generally get a horde.
No.
Actually, not even generally. You hardly ever get more than two or three enemies at a time, right?
Yeah.
But there's something very, very satisfying about being so overpowered that you can just slice through everybody.
Yeah.
But it does get boring, right? Because if you can kill everything, then why... Why are you even going through the motions of doing whatever stupid quest you're doing? There's no challenge. There's no risk. There's, you know, the reward is probably paltry too, because you probably have everything that you want and everything that you would ever need. So why are you even bothering?
In that game, yeah, that is the case. But in a game that's linear, like an RPG, in that sense, you're striving for freedom or striving for unification or whatever. And the thing they don't integrate into those kind of games, like even KOTOR, you're fighting a big baddie at the end, and he's just another number grinder.
Right.
You know, there's no... I don't want to spoil... I can't spoil the end, unfortunately, because you haven't played it.
Please don't.
No, I'm not going to spoil the end. It's just... It's the typical kind of... if you haven't leveled up enough, you won't win.
Well,
kind of thing.
And I played I played BioWare games. Every BioWare game, I believe.
Oh, any RPG.
And they're all pretty much the same, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm just waiting for that kind of revolution, though. Because I think there will be a revolution at some point where it's not about grinding anymore. It's about the experience more than it is about the grinding.
Well, Mass Effect and Mass Effect 2? I haven't played Mass Effect 2. But from what I hear, and I do know Mass Effect, it really is about the experience, because you hear these vast level disparities of people who completed the game. Yeah. Some people are completing the game at level 32 or out of 50. Some people are at level 50, and that game was very much about the experience. It was not as much about grindy. There was some.
But you could say that about like Oblivion, but the way it scales the game, it isn't fun.
Right.
In that sense. Well, do you know what I mean?
And the first thing I did, well, not the first thing, but one of the first things I did in Oblivion is go get the mod that takes off the stupid scaling, right? Because the scaling was ridiculous. I shouldn't be a level 15 guy scared of rats. Sorry. that's just stupid. But, you know, in Dragon Age is another good example of, even though it's more of a traditional RPG, it really is all about the experience. If you are trying to play it as a traditional grindy RPG, I would submit, and I hate people, I don't want to be that guy who says this, but I'm going to be that guy and say this, you're playing it wrong. If you're worried about making the right decision if you're doing a min-max job on Dragon Age, something is wrong with you, I would submit. You really should not worry about making a mistake, because, you know, BioWare is not going to let you make too many fatal mistakes.
No.
It will let you fall off a cliff every so often, but generally, the game is forgiving enough that if you do that, it will catch you. There is a way out of whatever stupid Hobbesian choice that you've made.
Yeah.
And it really is all about experiencing the dialogue and the people and the interactions and the setting and everything like that. And
Didn't you say that you had to restart because you made some bad choices?
I restarted because I wanted to see more of the origin stories.
Okay.
And I'm playing through a little. I haven't played in a while. That's why I'm kind of sorry I brought this up. But I'm playing through now as a totally different character from my first all the way through playthrough.
Yeah.
Just so I can see more of those interactions and make different choices and do different things and see all the little, you know, Dragon Age is a very micro game. I mean, the macro game, the big quest stuff is very traditional and very cookie cutter in a lot of ways, but the micro pieces are so brilliant, because if you go on a given cookie cutter quest, but you take different people with you, you'll have a different experience, and not just because of the way the numbers grind out. I took a rogue instead of a extra fighter, tank, blah 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 blah. No, I took this rogue and this magic user and this fighter as opposed to these other guys, and I got totally different party interaction. I got totally different a totally different experience. I got totally different dialogue options, you know, because all the party banter, they really take it to a fine art, and that's really the cool stuff. And then that shared sort of experience that you have with this party really makes the game special in a way that I haven't never seen in an RPG before, right? Before, you internalize that. You know, you named named the fighter after one of your friends from school, and yeah. you make up little internal dialogue about, you know, what he says and how he reacts to these crazy conditions. And there's that word again. But in this, they verbalize it, and these people are more, I mean, I'm not going to suggest they're like real people, but they're more alive than in almost any game I can think of. And because you have no real agency over them, at least from a personality perspective, once you get in the battle, you do. You can go anywhere and do whatever. But from a personality perspective, you have no real agency over them. They seem more like real people. And they react different ways, and they have their own unique backstories and own outlook on life and their own worldview and their own experiences they bring to the table that they're willing to talk about. And it just makes it extremely deep and satisfying to see that. And then they have all these different matrices of interaction with all of the other characters, right?
Yeah.
So if you bring a good person and a bad person, there's some interesting conversation going on there, you know?
So do you think in my experience, Baldur's Gate 2 was the first game which really did this. Is this just like a natural evolution of that? So have BioWare taken what Black Isle, or who did Baldur's Gate 2?
Black Isle, yes.
Yeah. Have they taken what they did
first? No, I'm sorry.
And then expanded on it?
Black Isle published. BioWare wrote Baldur's Gate 2.
So BioWare wrote it, okay.
Yeah. So this is an evolutionary thing. This is an outgrowth from Mass Effect. Mass Effect had some of that.
But the seed, Baldur's Gate 2 had it first.
But the seed was really kind of in Baldur's Gate. Baldur's Gate 2.
Baldur's Gate 2 was the first game where you had your party suddenly interrupt your quest, and someone would say, "Oh, you bitch! I hate you, and why are you giving eyes to the main party leader, which just happens to be you?"
Yes,
that kind of thing, which was actually really cool at the time.
Yes, and so this is like that to take it to 11, right? That goes to 11 in Dragon Age. Because back then, even though the party members of Baldur's Gate 2 had their own sort of back history and backstory, it was pretty flimsy. It was kind of a D&D character sheet almost of depth. Whereas these really have, and I don't want to overstate this. I don't want to get all hyperbolic, if that's a word, but
hyperbolic.
You could almost lose yourself and believe that these are real people that really could exist, because they're so deeply rendered as individuals in the game world.
Yeah.
And so, I hope and I believe from what I've read and heard, and I'm trying not to read and hear too many things about Mass Effect 2, but I believe that Mass Effect 2 takes that to maybe not another level, but builds upon that as well. And so BioWare seems to be really, really into that interpersonal relationship, those kind of stories between non-player characters and you as a player character, and then amongst themselves, that you don't really see in any other game or any other sort of game. They seem to be kind of masters of that craft.
Yeah.
So, whereas Bethesda, as the other, I guess, major role-playing game, video game company, they are masters of the big world with lots of little interesting things to do, but their characterization's kind of crap.
Kind of crap.
Well, okay, I was being charitable.
Don't need a qualification there.
Yeah, it's pretty crappy. They do a pretty bad job of it.
The funny thing is, as well, is in my opinion, Bethesda are really rubbish at the overall story, but the way they colour the world, the way they add little items to it, little scenes, is really, really above anyone else.
Yes, I would agree with you on that. I think their masterfulness is. about giving you a big world with lots of interesting things to explore.
Mm.
And there are a lot of emergent, I hate that word, emergent, so I'm going to use
it twice. It's good.
Scenarios that arise from this simulation of a world that they have out there. So you can go out, Fallout 3, run around, you see a battle just out there in the middle of the wasteland between robots and raiders. And that was, well, I'm pretty sure that wasn't scripted. I'm sure that that just happened, right?
Yeah, and, I mean, like, a couple of times I had that. I reloaded, went to a battle, and I found someone, and he was killed. And I thought, actually, I want to be able to talk to him, or meet him, or whatever, or fight him. And I reloaded, and it was a completely different battle when I got to it, because I hadn't, you know. So it was just like a kind of, maybe an encounter, but it wasn't so scripted that it was a certainty.
Right. So they are, you know, very much masters of that open world exploration RPG style of game. Whereas, you know, BioWare, not so much. I mean, if you look at Dragon Age, it's very much a point to point, very similar to Baldur's Gate. You know, you go here, you have that experience, then you go to the next thing and you have that experience, right? So there's no in between. Whereas in a Bethesda game, it's all about the in between. I would suggest.
Yeah, right? I agree as well. Yeah.
So
can you imagine? I mean, I'm talking hypothetically here, if Bethesda and BioWare and ID, now that they're under Bethesda's wings, kind of thing, if they all got together and made a game,
it would be either totally crap or totally awesome.
Yeah, it'd be like Troika, wouldn't it?
It couldn't be anything but totally something, right? It would be either one end of the scale or the other, right?
Because you could have like the best engine ever, the most optimized, perfect engine ever, like the best macro storytelling, the best character interactions, and the best kind of micro storytelling, and it could be the most incredible game ever. But
it'll be 500 gigabytes.
Well, I know it would use the mega texture technology, wouldn't it? So it'd only be like 32, but it would be like kind of scaled.
Right. So my last game I want to talk about is this little game. It's an independent game called Aurora.
Oh, yeah, you told me about this the other week, yeah.
And it's a 4X space game. Expand, exterminate, right? So
something.
It's, first of all, it's ugly. It's ugly as sin. One of my friends calls it 2001, the Excel spreadsheet. and it's because it's written in VB6, and it uses all the wonderful user interface conventions of Windows from 1998.
Wow.
So it is ugly as hell. The graphics are bad, to be charitable. Not only are the graphics bad, but the user interface is bad because it's very difficult to know what you're doing and how to get at the information that you need to get at to be successful at one of these games. So the learning curve is not really a curve, more than a, I don't know, asymptotic maybe. Okay. It's very, 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 very steep. So
exponential?
It's exponential, yes. It's an exponential learning curve. But I've been playing it every night for the past month because there's such a depth to it that no other game of this genre has ever even approached. It's always abstracted out a lot of the, every other game, every other space 4X game has abstracted out something in the gameplay to make it more accessible to users. And this game does none of that. There is no abstraction. I mean, you are responsible for everything. You're responsible for assigning research scientists to specific projects. You're responsible for designing the components that go on your ships. You're responsible for designing the ships then.
Are there any, like, because I know in things like Galactic Civilizations 1 and 2, there are kind of AIs which you can set to do these things for you if you're not feeling confident in them.
Nope.
There's nothing like that.
None of that. There is no AI. The closest you get to some help is you have some automation, the ability to automate some tasks, but only for your ships and only for certain missions. So, and by missions, I mean, for instance, you build a ship, you want to, you have an asteroid that has some minerals on it that you want. You have to, you know, here's the steps that you have to do. You have to research the technology for the, for a gadget that goes on your ship. You have to then go design the gadget, and then you have to research the gadget. Then you have to take the gadget and put it onto your ship, along with all the other gadgets that go on the ship.
Yeah.
Right? And that makes a ship class. Now, you have to go and build an instance of that class at one of your shipyards. And once you're, once that's built, then you have to go tell it to pick up automated mines that you've built, that you've been building also, that you had to tell it to build also. At the same time, you have to tell that ship to go pick up the automated mines and then take them to the asteroid and then go mine, start mining the asteroid. And oh yes, you have to know that you have to build mass drivers to go take to the asteroid so they can send them back to Earth. Otherwise, you need to build a freighter to go out to the asteroid and pick up the mine, the minerals every so often. And that's just mining an asteroid.
That sounds so complex that it sounds unenjoyable.
And yes, it's very, 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 very niche. Let's just be, to be very charitable, very, very niche. But
are you admitting to being an uber geek?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. But it's so cool because you totally control every little aspect of the simulation.
Yeah.
And there's so many interesting things to do and experience. You know, for instance, if you want to build a battle fleet, you have to do all of that that I just described for an asteroid. You have to design these ships. God. But each ship has to have its own place in your task force. So you can't have a ship that's good at scouting and firing missiles and firing beam weapons and command and control and carrying fuel. You have to have different ships that have specific roles for each one of these roles. And so it's, I don't want to say realistic because that's stupid, right? This is has no basis in realism, but...
Well, I mean, it sounds fairly realistic in the sense that you can't just have like some uber all-encompassing ship which can do whatever it wants.
Right. And so you... So to a degree that no other game has ever done that I'm aware of, and I've played most 4Xs because I love that genre, it forces you to be, you know, the emperor... And then also the head of the Bureau of Ships and also the head research scientist. I mean, you can assign, you know, commanders for ground units and then decide whether you want to give them a medal or not. And you can, you know, hire and fire each one of your captains and decide who gets what ship and who gets what role at the staff and who gets to sit on the beach. And that's just the personnel part.
Wow.
It's just so detailed, and there's so much there, and there's so much depth that, you know, you could poke around for a couple of hours and not really have done much, made any quote-unquote progress in the game, and just had a blast designing ship components. If you are of that bend, right?
That's your thing, yeah.
Yeah, which I guess I am, because I've been playing it a lot. It's very addictive. It also has, because it's turn-based, although it has variable-length turns, it does have that, you know, turn-based, one more turn sort of thing. So it's like, I need, you know, I'm about to have this research done, so one more turn. I got it. Now I can design a new, you know, a better piece of equipment. And there's some people who have played... I always start over because I always feel like I may make a fatal error, or I do make a fatal error. For instance, I made these awesome missiles, but my sensors could only go about a quarter of the way that the missiles could reach. So that seems like kind of a oops from a doctrine sort of perspective. So anyway, I don't want to talk about it too much because nobody will ever want to play it that would ever possibly listen to this podcast. But it's just so incredible. And this is why I love PC gaming, because something like that can exist.
Yeah,
that would never, ever, in a thousand million billion years, ever make it to a console. But because some guy has VB in a lot of free time and some knowledge on how to program, He can make this crazy, insane, detailed, totally Byzantine, obscure game that's a lot of fun. And, you know, and that's
it's there.
And that's the instance of PC gaming. That's why PC gaming will never, ever die, is because of guys like this.
Yeah. Yeah, and you see that time and time again. Like, not even... I mean, indie gaming, for me, is much more artistically orientated. But you have things like flight space sims, and they exist because, you know, there are independent gamers, so independent developers, you know, people like this guy out there who will just sit there and code it. And they're not the best thing ever.
Right.
But, you know, they exist and they fill a gap which won't be filled ever by the publishers.
Right.
And it is brilliant. It is amazing.
You know, it's just amazing that there's just one dude doing all this stuff. And, you know, and I've been out on the forums because, believe me, there is no manual and there is no help.
No.
And if you want to figure out how to do anything, you really have to go and poke around at the forums and ask questions and get with other people who are playing the game. And, you know, the guy is just very supportive and he's just happy people are playing his game. And, always on answering questions and talking about, you know, because he plays it too, and he's talked about his game, and he writes after-action reports, and it's very satisfying in a deep, nerdly sort of way. So, Aurora, in stores now. No, not in stores now.
free on
the internet somewhere. Google Aurora 4X, and you'll find how to get a hold of it if you want to find out about it.
No, that sounds cool.
So anyway, I didn't mean to take up as long as I did talking about my games, but
no, don't worry.
But I've been playing a lot of different things.
No, it's cool. It's good range of conversation there.
Yeah, I think so. So what about you? What have you been playing, man?
I'm only going to talk about two games.
Okay.
The first one, Batman: Arkham Asylum.
Okay.
I loved it. I think it's probably, I said on IRC before, it's probably one of my favorite games of the last 10 years.
Wow.
Which is saying quite a lot, really, considering the years we've had of, you know, between 2004 and 2008.
Yes.
But yeah, it's just so many. It's a third person kind of platform beat 'em up.
Right.
That's how I'd describe it, with puzzle solving and collection elements, and it's just it. To my mind, it's perfect. There's a perfect blend of all these different elements that have come together, and the developers have made it accessible because it's kind of easy to play, hard to master. That's the kind of design philosophy that's gone into this game.
Right.
Which is the kind of, for a console game, it's the perfect kind of design philosophy because it means that people can enjoy it on the very utmost level, the very, you know, very, very slightest level. But people who want to get into it further can delve deeper and get better scores or better times, or, you know, they can find more things. And so it's great. And also the thing as well, it's quite true to its roots. So it doesn't take, as with a lot of like kind of licensed games and stuff, it doesn't take that license and then crap all over it. As you know,
right.
A lot of licensed games tend to do.
Well, and a lot of Batman games in particular have done, right?
Yeah.
Batman's been traditionally a graveyard of games that have been built around the Batman franchise. I'm not aware of any good Batman game that's ever been made, with the exception of this one.
Yeah, I mean it's like Terminator games. You hear about Terminator games and you think, oh, crap. What are they doing?
Yeah, why are they going? Who thought this was a good idea again?
Yeah. Like even Terminator Salvation, that was like probably one of the better ones. But it's the thing that grabbed me most about the Batman game is, and you're probably going to hate me for linking this in again because I spoke to you about it previously, is how close it is to the design of Prince of Persia.
Okay.
So, Prince of Persia Warrior Within had the same kind of design elements. It had the kind of open world where you traverse between different sections, but obviously the kind of directed storyline that they both have. It had the skill set which you have from the start, but you don't necessarily know how to use, and you kind of utilize more effectively over the time you play it.
Right.
The combat system's kind of a bit flawed, but it's quite in depth. And then there's the whole, if you link that game in with the new Prince of Persia, the one that was released most recently on the 360 and PS3, and PC as well, you have the kind of collection there of collecting items and also the helping as well. In Prince of Persia, Warrior Within, when you died, you died. In the new Prince of Persia, you never really died because you were immediately saved. And it's kind of funny because a lot of people decried that in the new Prince of Persia. They said, oh, it's too easy, we never die, you know, there's no mortality, there's no pressure on you to perform well. And what was interesting to me is, as a player, Batman Arkham Asylum does basically the same thing. It just adds in an extra screen. So when you're, if you jump off a precipice or something in Batman Arkham Asylum, you have the option to press a button and then you automatically save yourself no matter where you were.
Right.
And it's the same kind of thing as Elika saving you, pulling you out of the abyss.
Right.
In New Prince of Persia. And then when you die in the New Prince of Persia, you're taken back to the last platform you were on. There's like an autosave system. It's not set to specific places in the world. It's set to whenever you were last on safe ground. And it's the same kind of thing in Batman Arkham Asylum as well. If you die in a fight, you're just put back to the last place you were safe. And kind of the same thing with the bat, what you call it, the bat grapple hook.
Uh-huh.
You put back to the last place you were safe. And it's interesting because all there is you have the option of saying, do you want to continue or not? And that's the only difference between the two games.
Right.
And I find it interesting that no one's decried Batman for doing the same kind of save system, as it were.
Well,
to New Prince of Persia.
And I know this is one of our topics for tonight, but the so I don't want to speak too much. Actually, I won't speak at all. I have some thoughts about that because I think there's a point to be made there that about the difference between the two games and why, even though one does one thing and another does almost exactly the same thing, one is decried, one is lauded for having the same exact design decision. So I don't want to get too... I have a response to that, but I don't want to get too into it. Well, actually, I guess we can, right?
Well, you can, yeah. I don't mind,
yeah. Here's the reason why. Batman's not supposed to die. Batman's the Batman. Batman is...
doesn't make mistakes.
Batman does not make mistakes. So it is okay to have a conceit in that you as the thumb-fingered player messed up. But the Batman's not supposed to die, so he gets a pass. So it's okay to rewind time, if you will, and allow him to get out of that perilous position that you, the external agency or agent, put him into. Whereas in Prince of Persia, if you are running around and you do, and he does something stupid, right, because he's the agent, then the Prince of Persia... he's nobody special. and I think the other part of it is that there's an external agent that you don't control that saves you, right? That keeps you from dying, whereas the Batman, as a solo character,
But mechanically, is that any different to the Bat grapple hook?
Mechanically, it's not, but I think internally, to the people who are playing the game, there's a world of difference, right? Because what it does is, if you are playing as the Prince of Persia and you make a bad wall run or you make a bad jump and then you die, quote unquote, and some external person or force comes back and saves your bacon, then it's like, well, no matter what happens, I can't fail. There is no fail condition in this game. So even if I'm an idiot and I jump off this same platform 1,000 times, which that would be me, the same person's going to always save me. There's no real risk. There's no real reward to that. I think
so I found that really funny because I mean I count myself as a fairly logical person, or at least I try to be anyway.
Yeah.
And like logically, those two systems are interchangeable. Interchangeable, yeah.
Yes. But I think the way that they're implemented is different, right? Whereas
definitely.
Batman saved himself because he was smart enough to fire his grappling hook, even though you, the player, are too stupid to know not to jump off a cliff. Whereas the Prince of Persia he has some woman following him around who saves him every time he does something stupid and falls off a cliff. Right?
Doesn't that speak to the strength of the character, though, the strength of Elika? Her being more wise to the ways of that particular world.
I think internally what it does is it takes the control of the character away, explicitly away from the player, right?
Okay.
So you as a player make a silly decision. The game in the guise of somebody else explicitly comes and saves you. Whereas you as the Batman make a silly decision, the Batman saves himself. And there is no logic to it. People aren't logical. I think what it is it just the appearance of player agency is maintained to some smaller degree in the Batman game. I mean, I've got the Batman game. It's on a console, so I don't play it that much. I played it a little bit. And it is a brilliant game. At least the 15 or 20 minutes that I've actually got to play it. I watched my son play quite a bit. He's a lot better at it than I am. But he died a lot because he just wanted to see what he was just messing around, wanted to see what would happen. It doesn't feel that save mechanism doesn't feel cheap.
Yeah.
Whereas the Prince of Persia, and I haven't played Prince of Persia, but I've read about it and heard people talk about it. That does feel a little bit cheap in that latest version of the game, where the same, not the same, but a similar mechanic in like the Sands of Time.
Yeah.
That
didn't feel cheap.
It didn't feel cheap, although, again, that's an interchangeable, mistake fixer upper, if you will. In the same series, a different mechanic, one feel valid and one feel invalid. I think because it's an internal to the player mechanic. It's not an external agency saving you, right? It's like,
yeah,
Elika is the hand of God and will always reach down and save you from falling. Whereas the Sands of Time is like, oops, I'm falling. Let's rewind time a little bit and let's try that again. And the same thing with the Batman. Oops, I made a mistake. But I'm the Batman. I don't die. Right, that would be ridiculous. So I'm gonna at the last minute fire grappling hook and save myself, and that's dramatic. And it doesn't make sense. It's illogical, but I think it is all in how the details of how that particular mechanic was implemented for those particular games.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a really interesting point. As we as humans, I mean, even myself as well, we accept, or we are less accepting of outside help or agency within a game.
Well, especially when a game makes you identify with an on-screen entity to the extent that these games do, right? Because you are playing the game, and for 95% of the game, you are in charge. You as the player are in charge, and
you're the hero.
You're the hero, and you're playing for hero fulfillment. You know, one of the reasons why you're playing is for hero fulfillment, I would suggest. And
yeah.
Right? I mean, why else?
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, I mean, to experience a story, but I mean, what is a story without a protagonist?
Well, right, and so part of the story is you being the hero, right? I mean, so for these sorts of games, especially, I mean, let's take Batman specifically. In the setting that he's in, he is a solo superhero, right?
Yeah.
And he does everything on his own. So when you as a player make a mistake, it's perfectly okay for the game to fix that for you because the Batman would, like I say, Batman doesn't die. Batman doesn't fall off of cliffs.
No.
Right? Batman always saves himself at the last minute, and that's dramatic, and that's drama.
Yeah.
And I think in the Sands of Time, I mean, not the Sands of Time, in the Prince of Persia game, what is the name of it again? The last one?
Well, I just call it New Prince of Persia because it's called Prince of Persia.
Okay, the New Prince of Persia game. New Prince of Persia game, had they done that same exact mechanic but made it more player-centric, right? Not have an external agency fix it for you, I think it would have been less derided. Yes, more palatable.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that's a very good point.
So that's, anyway, for whatever it's worth, that's kind of the thought on that.
I bow down to your superior intellect.
Well, even a blind squirrel will find a nut every so often, right?
No, I think that's an awesome discussion. I really enjoyed that.
We can come back to this in a little bit about, you know, when we get back on the topic of ease in games, but. Is that all that you had on Batman?
That's what I was going to say. I mean, the game I had was Borderlands, and I didn't really have much to say about that. Really, I mean, I just love it. It scratches that Diablo itch,
uh-huh.
but combined with a first person shooter, and the funny thing is, I would say the game itself is really nothing special. And it's kind of sad to say that. I mean, the visuals are, you know, post-apocalyptic, and you know, seen them before.
Right.
The gameplay, we've seen that before. You grind and you kill things, and you get new weapons and that kind of thing. But there's some indefinable aspect when it all comes together. The game is more than the sum of its parts. And I recommend anyone should try it. I mean, even if you prefer first-person shooters and you don't like RPGs, still try it. If you prefer Diablo and you don't like FPSs, still try it. Because I think there is something there that is special.
Huh. Well, I'll be honest, I've been tempted to pick that up.
If it's not important to you, then and get it cheap or get it rental because, you know, it's nothing worse than spending money on a game and then not playing it.
Are you playing online with folks? Or are you playing single player?
I play a single player by myself. Actually, I don't have a gold account on my Xbox.
Okay.
I really enjoyed it. There's something very satisfying about the way the weapons felt and interacted with the enemies, there are amazingly little asides and the main story itself isn't that incredible. It's not anything to write home about, but the little touches that the development team have put into the game, the little jokes, and what turn into in jokes are really enjoyable. They make the kind of immersion in the game really. Nice. Yeah, we can take a break. Yeah.
Well, no, I want you to finish off what you're saying. I want to hurry you up.
No, that's all I've got to say. As I said, I haven't really got much to say about it apart from I've really enjoyed it. It's one of those game experiences where you think I'm not entirely sure why I enjoy it, but I keep going back for more.
Well, that's what really matters, right? Is if you're enjoying it. I've been tempted by it, but I don't know if I have time for yet another game.
it's also one of those games where you don't get enough out of it. If you don't play it, you don't get enough out of it.
Right.
Because it is all about the grind. And if you don't grind, you don't progress. So you don't experience any of the things I'm talking about. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think what we'll do, we'll take a quick break here. And then we'll go on to our topic.
Fantastic.
Welcome back. The topic this week I thought would be about gaming preferences. It's one that Taylor's put forward. Basically, what we're talking about is how our gaming habits have changed over time. Like what types of games did you used to like but now can't stand to play? And what styles did you find, you know, uninteresting or you just dislike, and now you've gradually come to love and to cherish.
Cherish is a word. Oh, never mind.
I know. I was really stretching for my synonym zone.
That's good. Cherish is a great word. So you want to go first? Because I feel like I kind of monopolized that last section.
Don't worry about it. But yeah, I'll go first. I went. When I was younger, I was more about the instant gratification. So I would be all about first-person shooter or platforming games. Things like Cosmos, Cosmic Adventure, and like Commander Keen and Doom. Stuff like that. And Wolfenstein.
Right.
Basically, that's all I really played when I was younger. It was just those instant action. There was no progression of the character or the story. There was no progression of the story, really. There was no real story to those games. It was all about mastering the game, mastering the level.
It's about mechanics, right? It's about getting
mechanics. Yeah, you're right, yeah.
Pure mechanical games.
So I used to love things like Tetris and Columns and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But as I've got older, as games have matured themselves, I don't appreciate them to the same extent anymore. I mean, I played the new Super Mario Brothers on the DS, and I've played other platforming games. And quite frankly, I don't enjoy them anymore, really. I appreciate them for what they bring to the gaming kind of arena. And I appreciate that there is a lot of skill to go into designing these games. Mm-hmm. Because it does take a lot of skill to design a well-made platforming game.
Right.
But there's just... It's not the challenge that excites me so much anymore. I need something more. And I've gone from those like kind of Commodore 64, early 486, 386 games. And I've gone more towards RPG. Just playing a role.
Uh-huh.
So if you look at any kind of game that's released on a console now, you're playing a fully fleshed out character, or a pair of characters, or a group of characters. And there is, if you watch any film or TV show, there is a character arc, as they call it in the writing world. You know, the character kind of fills out and becomes more fulfilled. The character learns something, and that's something that I really gravitate towards in my games these days.
Uh-huh.
So I can't play games like Zuma and I don't know, these what I would call simplistic, even though they're not necessarily from a mechanics point of view. These simplistic puzzle games anymore.
Right.
I don't find them interesting. I just find them mentally vacuous, right. Basically.
Simplistic but not simple games.
Yeah.
It sounds like that you, and I don't want to read too much into this, I'm not a psychologist, but it sounds like that you're really getting more into story-based games rather than pure mechanical games, right? Whereas, yeah, like, you know, like platformers, they're about mastering a mechanic or mastering a system, whereas a role-playing game is more about mastering. Well, there's a system to master, but really, it's more about what's the story. What is? It's like going from reading. I don't know. I'm about to make a bad analogy, but reading. You know, early comic books, simple comic books, to reading, you know, novels written by the masters, right?
Yeah.
You know, reading cheesy Spider-Man from the 60s to reading Tolstoy. Sounds like what you're, you know, and I think that's great. I mean, you're just getting more, you want more depth and more experience out of your gaming time rather than just mastering a system or just, you know, getting that visceral shoot somebody in the head sort of thing. So.
Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying, actually. I mean, it happened around about the year 2000. I played Final Fantasy VIII, and that was it, really. I mean, I got into kind of story-based games, and from there, amazingly, I went on to, pardon me, like Baldur's Gate.
Right.
And the kind of Western RPGs, whereas normally, you're either one or the other, aren't you? I mean, if you... I don't know if you, people you meet online or in forums and stuff, they tend to be either Western RPG or, you know, Eastern RPG, like Japanese RPG.
Right.
Like exclusively. They don't tend to appreciate both, or at least not on the same, not on the same level.
Right. Yes. Yes. I'm personally a Western RPG fan. I've never been able to understand or appreciate what, Japanese RPG games bring to the table. So,
which I'm, yeah, that, that's fair enough.
Were there any other items that, that you've changed over, that have changed over time for you?
Well, I used to. Well, I don't think it's changed, but I don't get to express them anymore. I used to love flight sims.
Ah, yes.
And also space sims as well. So like F-117, X-Wing, Wing Commander, Privateer, Descent, and stuff like that.
Yes.
And they're just not really. There's a couple. There is one kind of freeware. No, it's not freeware. It's just you can buy it. I can't remember the name offhand. But there is one from an independent developer. Just one guy making it by himself. It's a bit like Privateer and Elite combined.
Okay.
But it's again, it's no real manual. It's not for the faint of heart. And there was one other game type I did used to love. Oh, I've forgotten it, so never mind.
Well, I mean, we can talk about it, because Flight Sims is one of mine as well. And it sounds like to me that you don't dislike Flight Sims. It's just that nobody is making a Flight Sim or a space sim that that allows you to play or scratch that itch, if you will. So it sounds like you would still like them if somebody would actually put one that was worth your while to play out there for you to buy. Or maybe not buy, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Whereas I kind of have gotten over the flight sim thing. I played, you know, the games that you listed, I played every one of those games. Yeah. And for a while I was a relatively serious flight sim player back in the, I guess, early 90s. I love that. I love Flight Sim. I love Red Baron, Secret Weapons of the Luftwaffe, B-17, all those games. I love those games. But somewhere in the late 90s, even when they were still putting some of those out, I just kind of got over it. I'm not exactly sure why, but they just, I take that back. I think I know exactly why they got, why I stopped liking them so much. They got too realistic.
Okay.
I'm not an Apache helicopter pilot, right? Had I wanted to be one, I probably would never have made it, but I would have tried to have become one.
You can't take one video feed from one eye and then like the actual real world from the other eye and combine them into one multitasking machine.
Exactly, exactly. And I don't want to. And so when flight sims get to the point where I have to worry about all the minutiae required to take off, right? And in the real world, it takes a lot. There's a lot of minutiae. You've got to check everything in your plane before you can think about getting in and turning on the engine. That's not fun to me. No. I don't want to do that. I want to hop in a plane and fire it up and let's go. And so when the simulations got to be too technical and too demanding and too realistic, I'm out. I'm sorry. I'd much rather play Gunship on the Commodore 64. Right? Maybe you remember that, maybe you don't, but that was an Apache helicopter simulator. It was rather technical for its time, but it walked a fine line between being too technical and being a lot of fun. And then flying Jane's Apache, you know, 64H or whatever it was, where you just have to worry about so many things in order to get your helicopter off the ground. That's not fun. No. Right? And going up, you know, and there are a lot of people who enjoy this, but I don't. I don't like to take off and crash immediately because I forgot to turn my flaps off or whatever. Right? That's not fun for me. So, I think that's exactly when flight sims stopped becoming fun, is when they got too realistic.
Okay.
And I'm speaking mostly about flight sims.
Yeah, not so much like space sims. Yeah, space sims. Never really the same.
Right. Space sims are, by definition, unrealistic because nobody's made a Viper, right? No. Nobody's made Kilrathi, Drothi, or whatever, right? So,
yeah.
Those are still fun, and I had a little bit of fun last year playing X3, which is an insane, deep Eastern European space sim game.
That, to say the least.
Yes. But it was fun for a bit, but it was too technical as well. Like I say, I don't want that level of... Which is kind of odd coming from me, who just raved about Aurora, which has the insane level
management side of things,
insane level of detail for a 4X game. But for those flight sim games or space sim games, I just don't want that level of technical detail. Even X-Wing, and I loved X-Wing, having to manage my power and shields and redirecting
things.
Was it
too much for you?
It was a little bit irritating, I will admit.
All right.
It was a little bit irritating.
The thing that got me for X-Wing was the fact that it was just impossible. Like, the actual fighting and the managing of your shields and energy and power and stuff was fine. But it was just the fact that they set up such impossible odds
right. And
such hard tasks that it was unfun to retry that. Again, 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 again.
Well, and the missions were too long, so if you failed, it was like you're back having to spend 30 minutes doing easy stuff, and then all of a sudden, to get to the point where you're going to fail again. And I found that part of that was the, you know, kind of the technical manipulation of the minutia of your, you know, whatever ship you were flying, helped make those tasks not less fun than they could have been. And I enjoyed X-Wing a lot, but that took some of the fun out of it, trying to manage that stuff. And I'm sure anybody who's listening to this is going, oh, what a baby. But
no, I'm not.
but really, I mean, if you go back and you play that, it's like, no, I'm sorry. Diverting power from my laser recharge to my rear shield because, some, you know, 10 TIE fighters are on my butt, that's not fun. I just want it to kind of happen. And maybe I have to – maybe as a pilot I have to do something. I shouldn't have to do 14 or – I'm overstating. Four different key presses to make that happen. I should just be able to say redivert power and then it just take care of it. So flight sims, I'm definitely over. And even if they have a renaissance,
I think they would come back as something else. As I mean, the last really kind of flight simmy arcadey kind of game we had was Hawks. You know, Tom Clancy's Hawks.
Right.
And that was pretty arcadey. It was that literally you press a button and everything dies. When I played the demo.
Right.
I just lost interest immediately. There's no challenge at all.
Right, and so I guess I don't want it to be too easy. I want there to be some simulation there. That right after all, it is a flight sim. It's not...
Yeah.
But I don't want it to be so realistic that... You know, if I put 100 hours in on this, I could get my pilot's license. You know, that's not what I'm after. I'm after just having fun with, you know, flying around and shooting stuff, or, you know, even a civilian flight sim, flying around and seeing stuff. Right. That's kind of fun, but it's not fun if I have to worry about, you know, IFR rules or, you know, whatever. Right.
Yeah. I mean. It's interesting because over the last couple of years, a couple of studios tried to bring them back. So there was that was it Wing Commander or something? There was a Wing Commander game on the Xbox Live Arcade. But the one I'm thinking of is the Star Trek DAC, where you're like a top-down kind of something or other. But do you think that's the way that they? If they do come back, do you think that's the way they'll come back? They'll come back as kind of super light arcade existences, or do you think it'll be something else?
No, I think it'll. You know what? I think the industry is ripe for space sims specifically. I think flight sims have done their. I think they're dinosaurs, right? I think they're fossils at this point. I think there will be. One guy or a couple of guys somewhere making a really cool flight sim for people who want that sort of thing. But I think this industry is ripe for a good run of flight sims, whether it's somebody digs out Free Space and makes a modern Free Space that's really slick and really cool. It has enhanced user interface, enhanced AI, and all the other bells and whistles that have come into play over the past decade since the last Free Space, or, you know, Star Wars comes back into vogue a little bit, and we get X-Wing game or a TIE Fighter game that's remade in a modern, you know, with modern tools and in a modern setting. But I really think that there's a pent-up need to have those sorts of games, right? And we see these things go cyclically, right? And I'm about to pull a massive seg on you here, yeah. But just like adventure games in the past were dead, and now they're come back with a vengeance. I think.
It's kind of, have they come back with a vengeance, or are they just back?
Well, from being dead to having some relevance, I would call that a vengeance, right?
I don't think they enjoy any kind of mainstream exposure or kind of penetration.
Perhaps.
I mean, you've got Telltale.
Yes.
That's pretty much it, isn't it?
Well, you know, the new Monkey Island. The remake of the Monkey Island was something.
And who's that by? Do you know?
I don't remember who that's by. It's not Telltale. Telltale did the new Adventures of the Monkey Island. Yeah. I think if you go look, there are more adventure games being released than you think.
But they were always being released. There were always like kind of Eastern European development studios making like small, like Siberia and stuff like that. They were always being released over the last 10 years or so, but they weren't heavily marketed and they weren't prevalent in the US, especially.
Okay, so maybe I'll rescind my vengeance qualifier, but I still think that genre in 2003, say.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I agree.
You know, you could go see its grave, right? You could put flowers on its grave, and now it's actually, there's a market for it, and games are selling pretty well. And so I think that genre has really made a comeback. That's a genre that I used to love and have a lot of affection for that I totally could not care less about anymore.
Okay. How have your gaming habits changed? Or what kind of games did you used to play? Apart from Flight Sims.
Apart from Flight Sims. So as adventure games are a genre that have been making a comeback that I used to enjoy and have a lot of fondness for from, the 90s when they were really in their first heyday.
Yeah.
And that I just really don't care anything about anymore. I played some of the, Sam & Max, the new Sam & Max games that Telltale had put out, I guess a couple of years ago, and I played the first two or three episodes, and I just, I don't care. I'm not exactly sure why I don't care, but because they were pretty funny. The stories were interesting to some degree, but I guess the mechanics of it turn me off now.
It's a lot of trial and error rather than actually any kind of logical thinking, isn't it?
Right.
There's no working out of things. I tend to hit a wall, and then I have to try everything I can think of.
Well, it's adventure game logic. It's not logic, right?
And so you
have to guess what the designer intended, and I just don't have the patience for trying to understand or trying to read the mind of the designer in order to get through those sorts of games. I just don't have the patience for it. I don't want to guess what somebody was thinking when they put this particular mechanic in this particular spot of their game.
Yeah.
And I would much rather experience their story, because some of the stories are very good in adventure games, but like I said, that's a genre that I played a ton of back in the day, and actually stupidly I bought Gabriel Knight off of Good Old Games last week, and I fired it up, and I'm just, man, I really like this. This is not fun. It's just not fun. I'd much rather punch myself in the face than have to work through that.
There is like kind of a layer of a kind of obfuscation there between you, the game, and the designer. And it kind of, everything conspires against you. It's not, it's like, you're not playing the game, you're playing the frustration rather than the game, which is a bit strange to say.
Right.
I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it makes perfect sense, because you are, like I say, you're playing the game by rules that are not explicitly told to you that may or may not have any reality, quote unquote, or any bearing in your reality, but have perfect reality in the game setting. But you not being a person who has any background or experience in the game will not know what those rules are. So,
yeah.
And the rules are arbitrary, because what may make sense in one puzzle does not necessarily follow that the next puzzle you see will have the same sort of logic basis.
Yeah.
And that's very frustrating, where you don't really learn anything that you can apply later on in the game from a given sequence. Not necessarily. Now, the best ones do, right? The best ones do kind of bring you along and let you learn
a little bit.
But even those, they always seems like they have some kind of random twist that gets you, right?
I mean, even like games like, classic games like The Dig.
Yes.
Like they had those rods you could configure to open doors and stuff. And I'm pretty sure most of them I just worked out randomly, I think.
Right.
Because I couldn't work out.
Yeah, the game didn't teach you how to use them correctly or didn't teach you well enough. And that genre is I'm pretty much past. It would have to be a very spectacular game for me to want to go back and play an adventure game. I mean, I loved Monkey Island. Played all three of them when they originally released.
Did you complete them?
I want to say I completed them. I could be have a faulty memory there, but I want to say I completed all three of them. It has been a long time, but I do remember enjoying the heck out of them. But when this latest release, you know, of new episodes from Monkey Island, I mean not Monkey, from Telltale, came out, as well as the release of the first one, right, all up-res'd, but still, you know, perfect recreation of the first game, but just in a modern user interface and a modern presentation that also you supposedly could toggle back to the original 8-bit representation, which is pretty cool. I just had no interest in picking those up.
No.
None whatsoever.
I mean, I never completed. I have to say, the only adventure game I ever completed was Day of the Tentacle. And that one is, by comparison, quite an easy game to complete.
Right.
Like a lot of people, you know, proper adventure gamers kind of love the game but deride it for its easiness. But yeah, even Monkey Island 2, which I got right to the very last kind of level, as it were, of completing, I couldn't get a time, because kind of the last puzzle was kind of timing based.
Yes, I vaguely remember that.
You had to kind of do something before someone walked into a room and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't have that kind of mind. I'm not smart enough in that particular way. To work out those games.
Right.
And I always played on the easiest mode or easiest setting. I'm intellectually challenged in that sense.
Yes, and I think that's just the tropes of the genre and where it came from kind of forced a illogicness to the gameplay that, in order to extend the game in a way, right? Because if the adventure's too short,
once you can do it, it's done, isn't it?
I'm sorry.
So once you can do it, it's done.
Yes, once you know the trick, then it's over, right? You really can't go back and re-experience that. And you know, to be honest, a lot of the fun of those games was figuring that piece out, that aha moment, right? It's like, aha, yeah. I figured it out. I know how this works now. This makes this makes sense, even though it really doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But now it's maybe logically consistent or whatever.
It's like that's that moment where you can go, F you, designers.
Or that's mostly what I spent my time doing when I play these games. The last genre that I'm done with, or I think I am, that I used to just love, I used to eat them up, and I played a ton of them, is real-time strategy games. And it makes me sad, in a way, that this genre is dead to me, but it seems like real-time strategy games have gone in two opposing directions, right? So you have one, and I've never played this game, so I could be misspeaking, right? But everything I read kept me away from this game. On the one hand, you have something like Command & Conquer 3.
Yeah.
And Command & Conquer 3 Red Alert, which are highly technical, the real-time strategy part, right? A lot of units, a lot of quick snap decisions, a lot of twitch skills. And Command & Conquer Red Alert 3... supposedly,
it's like a squad-based game, basically.
Each unit has different powers that you have to trigger. And so my patience for that sort of twitch-based real-time strategy stuff is gone. I don't have it. I don't want to play that. This just doesn't sound fun to me. At the other end of the spectrum is the Relic games, specifically Dawn of War 2. A lot of people really like that game, but I think I have a hard time calling a game where you have control of only four units a real-time strategy game.
See, I find that interesting because I would class them down the same end of the spectrum. Because it's all about micromanagement more than the actual strategy in those games.
Well, you have a... I guess you do have a point. I guess the frenetic nature of on the one side versus the, I guess a little bit more methodical and... more methodical and paced representation on the other side is where I guess I'm drawing my distinctions, right? Because, yes, the real-time strategies games have gotten too daggum far into the micromanagement side of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are games that go the other way. There's, like, AI War and Supreme Commander.
Right.
And to a lesser extent, Sins of a Solar Empire. That's, like, the kind of the other end of the spectrum where you have no control over, really, the micromanagement side of things, because if you did, it would be ridiculous.
Exactly. And I like Sins, but I don't play it that often.
Yeah.
And I think because... I think because I'm a solo player, and Sins generally tends to be the same game every time when you're a solo player. And not exactly the same way, but you...
No, I understand what you mean.
And, this is what really, really made me sad. I reinstalled Rise of Nations, Thrones and Patriots, which I've always considered to be one of my top five games of all time. I love that game. I played the hell out of that game back when it was released. And I reinstalled it on my PC this past week. And I went through it and I played it. And I'm halfway through it and I'm like, I've played this game. There's nothing really new here to see or do.
Yeah.
And that really kind of makes me sad, because it's really sad when you go play one of your favorite games of all time and it's not your favorite anymore.
No.
It's not that great. So for a lot of reasons, it sounds like I'm just done with real-time strategy games. I don't really want to play them. They're not that exciting for me. It's not that interesting for me anymore.
Did you ever play any of the Total War series?
Total War.
Like Rome?
Yes. I played
like Medieval.
I played all of them except for the first one, Shogun. I missed the boat on that one. But I played Medieval and Rome and Medieval 2 and Empire And
how do they? You played Empire as well. Okay. Yeah. How do they slot into that? How?
So I don't think that they are real time strategy games. Or, and this is going to sound, I think I'm kind of painting with a broad brush here, but to me, the real time strategy part of the Total War series is almost a mini game, right? Because that's not what the game is about, in my mind, to me at least. And maybe it's because of my predilection for this, but in my mind, the real part of the game is the strategic part, the turn-based world map part of it. And the real-time battles always seemed a little gimmicky to me, and they're not deep enough to be that meaningful, but they're detailed enough to be annoying. I can't really treat it as a war game, right?
Yeah.
Because there's not enough war game pieces in that part of the game to do war game sorts of things to really set your troops up and to do a hammer and anvil maneuver, for instance. You can fake it sometimes, in some ways, right?
Yeah.
But you're not really pulling that off. You just set these guys to go here and these guys to go swing around the other side. You're kind of faking it out. But on the other hand, there's a lot of guys. You have to manage them all because they're stupid. The AI is not very smart.
Yeah, they are pretty stupid. Yeah.
And so it's just something that you have to kind of deal with. And so I've gotten to the point where in Empire, I never played the real-time part. I just let my stupid generals go, and I just made sure that any battles I fought would be, I would have such overwhelming force that even my stupid generals would be able to win that battle. So, I don't really consider the Empire.
You're more of a Civ player in that respect.
Yes, very much so.
Well, fair enough.
So, yeah, I mean, like I say, it's sad because I was on the real time bandwagon all the way since Dune 2 came out. I remember playing Dune 2 and just enjoying the heck out of it.
It was an amazing game.
It was totally amazing because it's totally different from anything that you've ever played before.
Yeah, yeah.
And followed the genre along, played probably every major real-time strategy game from Dune 2 up until, played Dawn of War, Company of Heroes, and just at the end of those, I'm just like, I'm just done. Just done.
Fair enough.
So, yeah. I guess. I think one thing that's interesting, Jim, from both of us, and we, as we've mentioned on previous podcasts, we've been playing games for a long time, and we played a lot of different games.
Making us sound old now.
Well, I am old, so I'm proud of that. when you're as old as I am, you got to take pride in something, and I take pride in being this old. So,
Fair enough.
But, we played a lot of games, and we've been playing games for a long time. But it sounds like one thing that's interesting that both of us kind of share is we're kind of going more toward, more immersive, more story-based gaming. Which I guess is a good thing because that's the way the rest of the industry seems to be leading us, right?
Yeah.
And so is it really, and this might be too deep for this long into the podcast, but is it... is it because our gaming styles are changing, right? The things that we find we like and find interesting to play are changing, or is it really a reflection of what the industry is offering us to play?
I mean, I would probably say we are the seeds of change. My ego says, we were the people who were buying and playing games 10 years ago that set this in motion. Because this kind of change doesn't happen overnight.
Right. That's true.
It's the kind of thing that happens slowly with time. And I think... I don't think... I mean, I am a hardcore gamer. The way I define hardcore gamer is someone who plays games, who thinks about games, who discusses games, and who, you know, who would like to design games. That kind of person has that very intimate relationship with the medium.
Right.
It's like, I'm not, you know, a film aficionado. You know, I watch films, but I'm not a film aficionado, whatever you call them. I couldn't comment on, you know, the directing style of Ridley Scott or whatever.
Right.
He's not a director, is he? Never mind. So that's how I define hardcore gamer, and there aren't many people who are hardcore gamers. But I think, yeah, the game industry is driven by people who are the kind of the core gamer, as it were, who are just the people who play games and purchase them. And there is a difference between hardcore gamers and the core gamers, as opposed to the casual gamers in the way I kind of define them.
Okay.
Because the core gamers will buy Fallout 3, they'll buy, you know, GTA, and they'll buy Modern Warfare, or, you know, Call of Duty, and that's pretty much all they'll buy. But they'll play those games to death, and they won't think about the wider ramifications of, you know, the way a game is reflected in society, or they won't think about, you know, the relationship between GLaDOS and Chell,
uh-huh,
being like a mother bringing a daughter into the world and helping her grow up and stuff like that.
Right.
It's a different way of thinking about games, and it kind of to get back onto points. Those people will drive what games are made, because that's where the demand is. And they have the kind of purchasing power to kind of make them do that.
And the numbers.
And I think, and I think at heart, a lot of hardcore gamers appreciate those games just as much as those core gamers do as well. You know, I mean,
uh-huh,
we all appreciate, I mean, I don't know about you, but I personally prefer Empire Strikes Back to the original Star Wars. I think it's a better film. I think it's better made, and you know, the film critics tend to agree as well. So, and that kind of preference has been reflected in filmography. I don't know what it's called, but in cinematography as it's kind of
sure,
grown forward.
Sure.
I mean, you know, give or take,
uh-huh,
flops like Transformers. Well, not flop, no, but you know, critical flops like Transformers and you know, Indy 4. You know, those experiences kind of, they not dictate, but they inform future generations of entertainment media. And I don't think that those kind of experiences are incompatible with the hardcore game mindsets.
I think, in my mind, you know, using the terms that you've outlined, I mean, I think hardcore gamers will buy the games that core gamers will buy, but will buy other games, right? Other more niche games as well, because they're interesting and, or they have something to say, or that they're different experiences. They're, you know, hardcore gamers tend to look, in my mind at least, tend to look for more experiences from their video gaming time than a core gamer. A core gamer buys a game that they can play socially, perhaps, and maybe I'm painting with too broad a brush, but something that a lot of people are playing,
they can
play online with their friends.
They can just, like, discuss and, on a kind of macro scale.
Right. Yes, they could go talk over the water cooler with their buddies at work or their friends at the bar. And, but a hardcore gamer will tend to, I think, buy or play something like Aurora, which is totally
hardcore.
Totally hardcore. It's because you're there for the experience. You're not there necessarily just for the gameplay. Not just not for the social experience.
I think possibly we should wrap that up. So this has been Taylor Boone and James Proniast. saying goodbye.
Night, everybody. We'll be right back.